thank you very much. You know, the bad news is that I am in the chair again. Our chairperson, Ndiwe Maseke, has got apologies. She is writing exams yesterday and today. So all our best wishes go out to her while she's in the exam room, writing to be a good lawyer one day.
So
we are. We all wish her all the best for a good result. Can I just welcome the Naki? I don't know whether Dr. Tele will do the opening. If you can proceed to introduce your team, and then over to you. I'm not going to allow the committee to introduce themselves today. I think by now everybody knows each other. But if you just do a short introduction of the department, and then we can proceed. Over to you and welcome you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson, and good morning to all Honourable Members. Let me first apologize on behalf of Professor Sharon De La Rey, who asked that we apologize for her absence. We all know that the Vice Chancellors, they have to deal with the current situation related to the fee commission report. But we are grateful that Dr. Zajamin, who is a council member, is able to make it and has been entrusted by NECI Council to present the results of our monitoring that was conducted last year. The report was officially launched, Chairperson, on the 28th of September in Pretoria, and we subsequently had two roadshows in KZN and Cape Town. Without further ado, I would like to introduce my team. On my right, it's Dr. Zajamin, Ms. Pato Dube, Ms. Uzan Maila. On my left, it's Mr. Petros Letawa. And I think you all know the ministerial advisor, Mr. Martin Mantei. And Uganda is sitting there in the back. Thank you very much. I'm not so sure if you then
you
want
proceed.
Us to proceed.
You.
Thank you.
Good morning, honored members of the Portfolio Committee. Can you hear?
Yes.
Thank you very much for the opportunity of presenting the annual indicators report of the NACI for the Department of Science and Technology. It's a report that summarizes the key data that we identify with regard to science, technology and innovation. It's an annual report that we do. It's not identical from one year to the next. We collect sometimes different data for each report. We are trying to develop it as we go from year to year and to try and improve it. And I will give you some input into some of the adjustments that have been made to the report for 2016 compared with the previous few years. I would urge members of the Portfolio Committee to get hold of the actual report. It's got a lot of detail that isn't necessarily going to be contained in my summary presentation of it. And the other thing is that, in fact, I would urge you to look at some of the older reports as well, because they've got some information that I do believe is very useful, but which we don't necessarily collect every single year, but is of relevance. If I can then proceed to with my presentation, basically the presentation just looks at the global context in which the indicators were collected, the local context, some of the results, and then what I want to present is at the behest of the Minister of Science and Technology, we are in the process of developing what we call an innovation scorecard. In a way, I smile because I find it's typical American style of things, of doing things, but anyway, that's the way it's spreading out globally. Instead of having tens or even hundreds of individual indicators to tell you which way innovation is going in a particular country, you try and consolidate all these into a single measure, an index, called a innovation scorecard. And we are now working on developing this from year to year to try and track the progress that we make in science, technology, and innovation in the country. That is where I will be doing at the end of the presentation. Globally, the world is in a massive transition, the likes of which we've never known in our history. And of course, this encroaches very much upon developments in science, technology, and innovation. You've got huge mega trends, then, and the challenges that they contain, as well as innovation that is transforming all the time. I don't need to highlight all these noises that you hear are part of that environment that you encounter. And there are some major transitions that we're involved in. Some of the big challenges and opportunities are the huge increase in population that the world has seen over the last 50 years that is continuing, albeit at a slower rate, but it is resulting in the growth, and together with urbanization, is resulting in a huge increase in the size of cities and the birth of new cities around the world. In Africa alone now we have three cities going on five with more than 10 million people. Soon Gauteng will be one of those. Growing unemployment, climate change. I don't need to remind you of that when you have a massive drought in this part of the world. Massive, intensive migrating from one, you know, there's a move towards free trade around the world and connectivity and international capital flows, but on the other side there are attempts at halting human capital flows, and that's obviously sparking geopolitical tensions and the possibility of wars. This just summarizes more specific challenges, poverty, hunger, food, health and well-being, quality education. I don't need to remind you of the importance of that in our society at the moment. Gender equality versus inequality. And then you have some of the other issues such as clean water and sanitation, very, very important. Affordability and clean energy, that's also in the news every day. Decent work and growth. Innovation and infrastructure, reduced inequalities. And then, of course, sustainable development in your cities and climate action, the oceans, economy, life on land, peace and justice, and strong institutions and partnerships between various elements of society, including public and private sectors. In the local context, of course, we've got the National Development Plan, and as a member, we now have this new institution, or relatively new institution, called BRICS, to try and recognize the role and contribution of science and technology and innovation within that environment, and not to simply focus on what is happening in the advanced countries of the world. There's consensus regarding the need to shift from broad policy orientations to implementation. That is basically what has been lacking in our economy for many years, is the policies are put in place, but we don't actually necessarily implement them appropriately. NACI recently completed a 20-year review of the 1996 White Paper on Science, Technology, Innovation, and the Department of Science and Technology is finalizing a new let us move to the key trends and analyze the effects of the global economic crisis on unemployment, poverty, and inequality. And I'd like to emphasize that, you know, there's so much political noise in South Africa at the moment, and concentration on politics and the way that this is influencing the economy, but people forget that globally there is still massive after effects from the global economic crisis of 2008-09. One of my hobby horses is focusing on the fact that the after effects of that crisis have forced central banks to try and resolve the situation by keeping interest rates around the world abnormally low and pumping massive amounts of money into the world economy. The problem with that is that it is actually contributing towards higher inequality, because that money is going more into pushing up financial asset prices than helping to create jobs for the people on the ground. And so those who have access to financial assets are benefiting relative to the masses. We also have the whole issue of climate change and concerns about water scarcity, energy security around the world, and food security. And on the health front, we see the proliferation of new diseases that we never ever considered to be particularly serious. They weren't part of our framework. And being on the board of a healthcare company, I can tell you that there's been an absolute explosion in mental health diseases, for example, in recent years, which is unprecedented. Now, domestically, obviously, there is low business confidence in light of a number of developments, which I won't go into. And then, from a technological point of view, you've got the fear that the fourth industrial revolution and the progress in technology is going to result in more unemployment, not and exacerbate that problem. But on the other side, can we ignore all the positives from that can be derived from the advances in technology? Let me now move to the actual indicators report and start off by just summarizing it. An annual publication produced by NACI to assess the progress in the development of an effective and efficient national system of innovation. It's not a primary statistics report. We don't collect, try and derive the statistics. They are statistics that are available, and what we do in this indicators report is to combine them into a comprehensive whole that people can use as a benchmark to actually help them in looking at a variety of areas of science and technology and innovation that can be focused upon. And it's a platform for discussing the state of innovation in South Africa. You can see the interflow of the different elements of the indicators report. You know, it tracks advances in R&D capacity and in human capital, which in turn feeds into the ability to provide technical progress and innovation, and that in turn results in a lesser dependence on on imported technology, but also we need imported technology to assist in developing our own domestic system of innovation. So it's a two-way flow from that point of view. And the ultimate objective is to improve the quality of life and increase the wealth in society. It covers, the indicators cover the 20-year period 1996 to 2015. What we've done in recent years is to increase the level of detail in which we compare South Africa against various regions of the world, including SADC, Sub-Saharan Africa, Africa as a whole, the BRICS countries, developing countries, upper middle income economies, the G20, and the overall world. Now, notable new additions in the most recent publication has been the trends in mathematics and science at school. It's a global benchmarking comparison. We've got And one of the new areas of focus has been information and communications technology indicators, factor productivity, and JSE market capitalization by sector. Although, may I emphasize that the person compiling this report at the heart of it is the gentleman two on my left, Petrus Letaba, who's done an enormous amount of work in collating all these, but he's got a team behind him, and I think they've done an outstanding job. And however, occasionally we have areas of discussion and debate, and the one that I have is JSE market capitalization, because I have often wondered whether that is an appropriate benchmark to look against in terms of tracking size. Progress in science and technology, because I know that many of the companies on the JSE are no longer really South African. They've got most of their operations abroad. But anyway, we have included that and we do track it. Some of the key highlights are that enrollment on... I have to say that there are some encouraging developments and there are some really worrisome developments. And I'd like to try and highlight both of them. On the encouragement side, enrollment in science, engineering, and technology is gradually increasing, though it remains low at 29.9% of all students attending university are in those fields. And the proportion of females in SET has gradually been increasing from, you know, over the years, as I suggest there, from 45.5% in 2013 to 46.2% in 2015. That's not too bad, actually. I mean, relative to some other indicators, having almost half of people being female is quite encouraging. And the share of female graduations in science, engineering, and technology is even better. And that raises the question, why do females actually fare better at university than males in the area of science, engineering, and technology? And one of the big, big positives is the number of scientific publications has trebled from 25,000 in the final 5 years of the last century to 75,000 over the period 2011 to 2015. Though the share of engineering and technology publications remains stagnant at 13.9%. There's been a huge increase in publications across the board, and science, engineering, and technology has not increased its share relative to the total. Now, this is one of my big hobby horses at present. South Africa has one of the largest mobile cellular subscription rates in the world. And I keep asking myself, because I'll show you some of the other findings in a moment about education and where we lag behind. And there's such an overwhelming number of people in this country who have access to this. And I ask myself, and yet we've got one of the poorest outcomes in education, and I ask myself, from an innovation point of view, not only technical, but social as well, is there no way in which we can convert this technology into fast-tracking education and skills development? And the same applies to internet. Then the other thing that I'd like to draw attention to is the fact that I know we keep complaining about not enough foreign investment in the country. The fact is that multinational corporations in South Africa are playing a very important role in South Africa's technological innovation progress. The share of non-resident patents granted has increased from 46.1% of all patents in 1996 to 59.2% more recently. And the share of non-residents in industrial designs registered has increased from 45.6% to 69.5%. And that is why it is really worrisome when you hear about the possibility of a decline in foreign investment in the country. And you see the figures of the decline in foreign investment from 1.91% in 2001 to 2005 to just 1.32% subsequently, and the country's FDI as a percentage of Africa's FDI has declined from 14% in 1996 to only 3% in 2015. Foreign investment has increased massively in the whole sub-Saharan continent, in line with people getting more and more excited about the potential of the region, but investment into South Africa has been fairly stagnant, and so its share of that foreign investment has fallen off quite sharply. And related to this is a decline in the percentage of capital goods imported and a decline in country share of high technology exports. And we're falling behind in that regard. It's very, very concerning. Of course, at the heart of all this is, I believe, the deficit that is developing in our human capital development pipeline. Starting off with the extremely low scores in the trends in maths and science, no-fee public schools, poor early childhood development, and especially low scores in maths and science performance. I'll come to showing you some of them. Maths and science passes with 50% remain low, at less than 20% of those who go to school. That is, who start school. And let me give you a more dramatic figure. You know, if you go into business, you need to, if someone is going to be useful to you, he needs to have got at least, I'm not going to say 80%, but say 60% for maths in matric. And that's, you know, it's just good enough to be able to think properly and cognitively here. Now, in 2005, 12 years ago, there were approximately 1.25 million kids that began school at our public schools. By 2016, 12 years later, of those 1.25 million, 33,000 managed to get 60% or more in for maths and matric. In other words, just under 1 in 40. Now, that's just not good enough, because it's those very people who can use those skills to command a decent job, to earn a decent salary, and to be employable. And so this is at the heart of the high level of unemployment in the, and rising trend of unemployment in the country. Also concerning, there's been a slight improvement in the past 3 years, but you know it's marginal. The declining share number of female learners passing maths and science, from a gender point of view, which is also concerning. On a higher education front, the good news is that we are seeing an increased throughput of results from previously disadvantaged individuals, and in particular in postgraduate science, engineering, and technology enrollment, the numbers are significantly. But the proportion who are studying science, engineering, and technology when they enroll at university is remaining constant at, as I showed you earlier, 29.9%. Let me go into some of the individual numbers. The trends in international maths and science study. It's a global comparison, and I commend the Department of Education for actually including South Africa in this study, although I know that it is being opposed by some of the unions, but it does certainly reflect the deficit that we have, and you can see how poorly we compare compared with most of the world in some of the outcomes. And on the positive side, there was a relative improvement in some of the numbers from 2011 to 2015. If you want to say, on average, we have moved from having a ranking at 6% of the total to 10% of the total over that period of time, and in science from 7% to 9%. If we look at mathematics, these are the relative scores, and what this graph shows you, and I'm just picking, we've picked a few of the indicators which have, a sense and an implication, a broader implication. The one is to distinguish between those public schools where no fees are paid, those schools where fees are being paid, and those schools which are independent. And you can see just how much better the independent schools have been performing relative to the public schools where fees are paid, which in turn are faring much better than the no fee paying schools because of the quality of teachers that they are able to attract. And the relative deficit that we have in primary and early childhood development and primary education, I think, is absolutely critical. And one of the tragedies that I find about this whole fees must fall debate at university and tertiary education is that we have seemed to have diverted our attention as a country towards them trying to resolve tertiary education issues when the real problem lies with early childhood development and primary education, because it is there that you start educating the kids so that by the time they go to university, they are ready for university. A lot of the problem in tertiary education is that we get kids to come into university and then they are not ready for it intellectually. The primary and secondary education has been insufficient and then they fail. And we get a proportionately far too small a cohort of students starting university and actually finishing and graduating at the end of the day. And it's a huge cost to the fiscus. And I would just urge you to keep emphasizing that point that it, you know, we need to focus more in a way on early childhood development and primary education than on tertiary education. Switching now to research and development expenditure, and this is where an attempt has been made with the latest HERE Commission report to try and address the kind of lack of involvement, in a way, of the business sector in developing education and through that in research and development more generally. You see from these graphs that the proportion of research and development expenditure from the public sector has been rising relative to the business sector, which has been falling. And I think there needs to be far more. I think it's a function of the trust deficit between private and public sectors, but you know, the business sector just has to start playing a little more of a role in helping to develop innovation capabilities and getting involved with the public sector in developing the skills necessary to achieve this. One of the factors that you end up having is, for example, where this polarization between public and private sectors and insufficient skills development is the perennial decline in our manufacturing capability in South Africa. And the less you can manufacture domestically, the more you're dependent upon imported goods and services to keep your economy going. And the more you're independent on foreigners, the more you're dependent on foreigners to provide that know-how, the more vulnerable you are to being exploited and colonized as a country. On the positive side, you can see how we have made a lot of progress in developing technology and innovation in agriculture. And in a way, I mean, that is very simply reflected in the fact that the number of farmers in the country is now half of what it was 30 years ago, and yet the country is still, for the moment, self-sufficient in food because the amount that they're developing with technology is just that much more effective. Then the other side is to notice from these figures how the focus of the country's economic strength has shifted away from industry and manufacturing towards services all the time. And the concern that the government has is that proportionately services are often less labor intensive than manufacturing and mining sectors could be, and so that is conducive towards higher unemployment. This graph that I show you here shows the growing role of non-residents for South Africa's technical progress, and you can see how the number of patents granted to non-residents has shot up in recent years relative to residents. You can interpret it positively or negatively, depending on which angle you come from. But the really negative thing is the way in which foreign direct investment has actually declined as a percentage of overall foreign investment in the world. And especially if you benchmark ourselves compared with other regions of the world, and you'll see, for example, South Africa FDI inflows, percentage of sub-Saharan African FDI inflow has gone down from 22% in the year 2001 to 2005, down to just 4% in 2015. I know 2015 is a particular year, and these figures can be quite lumpy, so rather concentrate on the five-year period 2011 to 2015, but even then, you basically foreign investment inflow has halved as a percentage of inflow into sub-Saharan Africa from 22 down to 11%. And the same applies comparing us with many of the other groups of countries with which we can compare ourselves. And you'll notice, well, I look at it as quite interesting to see how our share of FDI rose dramatically between 1996 and 2000 on the one hand, and 2001 to 2005, and then has fallen off very sharply, showing how we were starting to make a lot of inroads in the early part of the century, and we've just lost our way from that point of view. And in particular, the proportion of imports that are capital goods with which to sustain economic growth in the longer term has diminished significantly over time. It's not dramatic, but it's a continuous and gradual erosion of our capital endowment from a longer term point of view. Then to flip through to the fact that we have such a high proportion of cellular devices in the country, look at this graph. I found it absolutely astounding to see how many cell phones we have in this country compared with the rest of the world. And as I say, you know, let's convert it to our advantage. Of course, one of the negatives is the cost of cellular. A lot of the people can't necessarily access data as cheaply as their counterparts in the rest of the world, and that inhibits the ability to piggyback on that in terms of advancing education. One innovation that we, in our indicators report this year, has been to draw information from private sector in terms of performance. And there is a study that is conducted by the management consultancy group Accenture, formerly Arthur Andersen, where they look at they compiled a study looking at innovation leaders, innovation laggards, and champions, and have looked at around 100 companies. And basically, the conclusion is that only a very small proportion of the companies that they have analyzed can they regard as real champions of innovation. So here again, it's absolutely vital to get the private sector more involved in this whole initiative of promoting education. Because without promoting education, yes, that was a Freudian slip, and innovation. You can see the share of exports by technological intensity, and you'll notice how manufacturing has declined over time, whereas you have seen the share of primary products, it has moved from one phase to the next. The yellow group, medium technology manufacturers, have seen a bit of a rise within their relative shares, and conversely, one sees that in the last 5 years there's been a decline in high technology manufacturers. All this feeds into the changing structural pattern of the economy away from mining and manufacturing towards services. And if you look at how the share of the economy going towards the orange line goes, you'll see the big winner has been 20 years, and community so wholesale, retail, and motor trade catering, its share has increased. Transport, storage, and communication, its share has increased compared with the bottom part, where the orange line is much shorter than the green line. Manufacturing, mining particularly, look at the dramatic fall of in its share of the overall economy. I know there's this emotional affiliation to mining as the cornerstone of our economy. Well, you know, its share has fallen dramatically over the last 2 decades. Just another one, how is South Africa doing in terms of CO2 emissions? From a, you know, should we be proud of our performance? Well, you can see our emissions have been declining gradually over the past 2 decades, and that's a positive development. And I think we should be starting to brag a little more about it relative to the rest of the world, that we are doing our bit. It's actually, as far as I'm concerned, imposing quite a constraint on our energy security, because we are being compelled by international sources to reduce our dependence on coal, and yet that is where we have a huge comparative advantage in this country, through being able to mine coal very cheaply. And I find it very sad, because it obliges us to then have to look to other sources of energy. I don't need to remind you of one of them, which is the subject of huge controversy at the moment. Concluding remarks, there is a clear need for deep transitions and a fundamental shift in the economy, as well, not much has changed. If anything, we've been moving backwards in terms of our level of industrialization in the country, and much of this has to do with the constraints and the deficit in science, engineering, and technology skills, particularly in design, engineering, entrepreneurship, and management. We also conclude that the national system of innovation is making an inadequate contribution to poverty reduction and wider inclusion in the mainstream economy. There are some areas of success, good progress in building critical mass for research capacity through a few prominent universities. And what has struck me is some of these data, which I haven't shown you here, if you look at the publications and patents and so on, confined to UCT, Wits, University of Pretoria, Stellenbosch, and to a lesser extent UKZN, and the rest. And this is a huge problem, because I see it when you're faced as an employer and a student comes to you with a degree from the University of Venda, and you say, should I bother employing him? That's from Venda. It creates this whole image of inferiority to some of our secondary educational institutions, which I don't know how one, you know, it's a challenge to try and get away from that image. The last bit I'd like to just focus on this new concept of an innovation scorecard, where we collate all the indicators and try and draw conclusions about how we are doing relative to the past and how we are doing relative to our peers overseas. The objective of the innovation scorecard is to enhance the monitoring of the innovation system by developing a composite innovation indicator for South Africa. The way we've derived it is to look at to review international composite indicators and try and benchmark ourselves compared with those indicators, to try and cover the various areas that we need to try and be as comprehensive about covering this whole realm of innovation as possible, and basically selecting the appropriate indicators with which to do so, and to pilot that. Why composite innovation indicators? They're synthetic. You know, in a way, on their own, the only meaning is for comparative purposes. They don't actually measure anything other than the average of the whole. They combine aggregate a number of variables into a single valued metric. They are useful as they are able to integrate large amounts of information into easily understood formats and are valued as a communication tool. They are also used to rank countries in various performance and policy domains, and I would suggest that notwithstanding the downward revision of ranking in the World Competitiveness Report, the fact that South Africa is able to produce a lot of these indicators actually enhances our ability to sustain a slightly better ranking than would have been the case if we didn't have those indicators report, and that in turn should theoretically enhance our ability to attract investment from abroad to a greater extent. We are seen as being that much more developed if we can actually measure these things, which most other African countries can't do. The characteristics are there are three pillars around which we've developed these scorecards. Those that enable innovation, then we look at the actual firm activities, and then we look at how, you know, we put so much in, how have we fared in terms of the outputs. And each of those we've broken into a number of dimensions, which I list there, and we summarized these. We basically used 20 indicators in deriving these synthetic scorecards, because we've got one scorecard for enablers, one for firm activities, and one for outputs, as you can see. Reading above one implies progress over the period 2010 to 2014, and a reading that is negative implies deterioration in our innovative performance. From the point of view of enablers, you can see that new doctorates per 1,000 members of the population, quite a nice score there, 0.43. We are actually producing quite a lot of success in terms of getting postgraduate people through the postgraduate system. The percentage of the population having completed tertiary education, it's improving. There's no question. It is increasing, not massively, but it is increasing. Our publications, as I mentioned earlier, we're doing far better than relative. We're punching far beyond our size. Scientific publications, specifically, we're doing okay, but not fantastically. R&D expenditure in the public sector, relatively speaking, the public sector is doing quite well compared to the private sector, but it's only marginally improved over the last 4 years. Where we are losing horribly is in terms of attracting venture capital to assist in innovation. These are summaries. Far more negative is to see what's happening on the ground in the private sector. And you see R&D expenditure in the business sector, negative score. Public-private co-publications, that has improved, actually, ironically, despite the lack of trust between the two sectors, but there has been some movement there. Patent applications per billion. So we're doing very well in getting these patents, but then applying them very quite poor. And ICT investment as a percentage of GDP, actual investment. We've got a lot of consumption of ICT, but actually investment into ICT is relatively lacking. And trademarks, we're performing very poorly, and business finance, you know, feeding into that venture capital. Business finance into higher education and innovation is very, very weak. And that is one of the areas where the Hare Commission is trying to promote more input from the private sector into tertiary education. And then from an output point of view, license and patent revenues from abroad have been doing very well. As I said, multinationals love to use South Africa. We're quite cheap to do a lot of the research that they actually produce. Contribution of high-tech product exports to total exports. Despite the deterioration, relatively speaking, in recent years, we're still punching above our weights. We've got some really high capacity, high cap- that contribution of exports in commercial services to total exports is poor. Life expectancy, we're featuring quite well, we've seen a slight improvement. I would say if you actually bring it up to date, I know the latest figures, the improvement in life expectancy is one of the big attributes of our economy at present, and that is due to our success in reducing the death rate arising out of HIV/AIDS due to free antiretroviral. Internet users as a percentage of population, that's the best score of the lot. And yet, here again, I come to the fact, if people are using cell phones and internet so much, why are we doing so poorly in education and skills development? And then GDP per energy use, and I know our dependence on electricity relative to every unit of GDP that we produce has actually diminished. We're getting more and more GDP out of each additional unit of energy. Just summarizing each of these into the scorecard, you see a slightly positive performance over the last over that 5-year period, 2010 to 2014, in the inputs that go into the innovation system. A decline in the role of firms in innovation, but you know, relative to what we're doing, I suppose the outcomes on innovation are not that bad. But clearly, we could achieve a hell of a lot more if we were to improve our, firstly, what we put into developing the human capital skills, and then applying those at the firm level. This is a pilot study. It is work in progress, and we'd love to, in years ahead, actually, you know, draw this out as an even more useful tool for your analysis. And I suppose that's a summary of the indicators report. But I'm happy to take it.
Thank you very much, Dr. Jamin, for that. Some of the indicators are, you know, one can smile about it, but the majority ones, the real game changers, you know, is still quite a concern. So it's over to Grimmie, who wants to ask questions. Let me start from the top, Honorable Ortiz, and then let's go down. King, Tuck, is there more? Over to you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for this presentation. It is extremely interesting, and I'm sure that reading the full report will provide much more background to this. I know you said that you basically worked with the data as you saw it, but could you perhaps give us some idea, what are your thoughts on why do we have such a low investment by business in terms of education and technology, research and development? Are there any specific reasons for that? And then secondly, just a comment on the possibilities that we have in terms of cell phone usage. I fully agree with you. And this is something that we will have to look at, is the data, because that is what stands behind, in between optimal use of this facility that we do have, with a very wide area that it covers. So is there any projects or research being done in terms of the data, the cost of data at this point that you know of, that one can use to get or to influence the companies?
Thank you.
No. We're going to do all questions. Honorable King.
Very interesting that you could highlight some results. That is one thing that I'm always asking when I see the committee. When I saw your indicators, it indicated that funded and non-funded schools are not performing that well as compared to the other two. That is a bit worrying for me, because if you have to consider then in the long run, it basically means that the kids that you actually wanted to achieve something will never reach that level. So I needed to find out from you, as the minister actually consulted with you, or actually sought your input, basic education minister, on how to address the issue of maths and science. I mean, I'm a maths teacher, so I know the problem. And I fully agree with you with early child development. More emphasis should be placed on that. And also I'd like to comment on the cell phone users. It's very interesting that you could ask that question, because there was once an app that was designed for maths. And when you use that, a cell phone app, and when you actually use that in your classroom for the learners, they were far more interested to learn more, because it's something that's useful for them instead of writing on the board. And they could actually interact better with us. So I was very glad when you mentioned that. But also with the mere fact that we are using we have so much cell phone users, it's very interesting that in South Africa, nobody has actually considered designing our own cell phone. Is there any investment in that? But it's not that it's high tech. We have never actually designed something that you would say the world would turn its focus to South Africa in the last few years. We have been mainly piggybacking on other people's ideas, and it never more had that impact that we should have in South Africa. So that's basically it. Oh, okay. The one question that I wanted to find, something that I find interesting. Do you think we should actually shift away more from academics to technical schooling? Thanks.
Honorable Taft.
Is it on? Yes, thank you for your presentation. I think I've got one answer here, and I think I've got the answer as well, but I'm still going to put it out there for you. It's on slide 10, page 5, the last paragraph on the background about South African SDI indicators report. This report provides a necessary platform for discussing the state of innovation in South Africa, it says. So now my question was now, or is, who do NACI discuss it with? Because dialogue is needed, as you declare also. So who, where, and when? It's expected that you should initiate the dialogue. Then I went to the next page, and it does give me, I think, an answer focus of this report. So if that is not the answer, you have to give me that. Then concluding on your concluding remark, you say there is a clear need to transitions for a fundamental shift in economy, as not much has changed since 1996. What I would like to know is, do you have a report on this, the shift of economy? Because it's quite important. I didn't see it in your document. That's what I'm asking. Then you also say there is good progress in building critical mass for research capacity through a few prominent universities. I am just like that. I would like to know why a few universities and not all of them. Because that way we can reach more. That's how I see it. And I would also like, who is those few universities that are benefiting from this? Yeah. And more positively, can we not spread it more? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir. My question is around the issue of math and science, that for you to be, it's just is an observation that I'm normally asking myself. Then you say, for you to say a child is intelligent, you must have math and science. You know? It's because that is one of the things that I pick up in South Africa. We are pushing for that. There's nothing wrong. But if I'm not a math and science person, what does the research say around that? Because I've seen people that don't have math and science, but those people can become innovative, they become creative, but they don't have math and science. So what are we saying about those people? Because for now, it's like, that's why most of the children go flat. Because in the class, it will be this kid that says, yo, you're good in math and science. Even buzzards will be given to them. But me, sitting there knowing how to make this pen, without calculating what you need to do, I'm not being recognized. And it's one of the things that I think it becomes a challenge in South Africa. Second issue. There's a young guy in KZN who wants his manufacturing cell phones. But that's where the country we're asking. Business people are not pouring money into that. You know? And yet, they are the same business people that say, there's no skills in South Africa. So that's why we are importing the skills or whatever. Then for me, those we need to deal with hardcore issues. In terms of research, because that's what I want to see in the research. Because most of the time we pass the buck. Where things are supposed to be happening, and we know. You know, I used to work for a company, I was working for Transnet. I pick up in Transnet. This gentleman, there were two gentlemen, they were very old. If they are not around, and the train gets stuck, tough luck, the train doesn't move. But these gentlemen could not even write their own names. All they knew is to put an X on the paper. And we are still not recognizing that. But when anything happens, we'll be stuck because now they have been taken to from home to come and fix the problem. But they could not tell you what is the problem. In my province where I come from, there's a young boy, he's a, what do we call them, Down syndrome. He gets into the car, fixes it. But when you ask him, what did you fix, he doesn't know. Because he cannot express himself, but he's got the knowledge. What are we doing with those kind of skills? Because that's where the thing lies. And we don't, when we do research, we don't do research around that. It's only around the intelligent one, in terms of math and science, and all those things. That's, maybe I'm out of the topic, but that's how I feel. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honorable Kakane.
Thank you, Chair. In fact, I wanted to listen, just to listen from my colleagues what is happening. Let me first start by saying that thanks for the report or presentation. I just wanted to ask a few questions, but mostly I'm covered by my fellow committee members. Especially when coming to the issue of mathematics and physics. The last speaker put it clear and is how I was going to ask you. And again, I'm struggling to understand why in your presentations you mentioned that public schools are struggling when coming to mathematics and physics. And you suggested that maybe the failure of having quality teachers. What do you think that what can be a remedy for this problem? And I just wanted to know in numbers. I like numbers than percentage. Yeah. I want to know how many designers or inventors do we have in South Africa or and inside the countries and in Africa. And I don't understand whether is a failure of our educational system or what. But it seems as even though we can have math and science and other children can be well equipped or very intelligent when coming to these two subjects. But I saw that even our tertiary levels, we are still failing to have, in fact, the major and quality engineering faculties. For example, where I come from, there is a child who passed 100% in mathematics and physics. And that child wanted to do quantum engineering. We found that there's no university in South Africa that has quantum engineering. Were you aware about that?
No, not specifically.
Yeah, I know you will answer when time comes. And in fact, according to your analysis, I'm happy because in your presentation, most of unresolved or maybe unanswered questions, you were trying to clarify according to the presentation. That's why our question cannot be mean. But I wanted to understand that, according to your analysis, what is the problem, clearly a problem, that makes our economy not to flourish, so that we will be able to then gauge if our economy cannot work, what will happen to certain countries? And you know why I'm asking that question? Because I can see that South Africa is the one in the SADC countries that feed other countries. Then, in Africa as a whole, what do you think it can be an answer to our economy? Then going back to BRICS, what can help us? I thank you.
Thank you very much, honourable members. If I can just from my side just make a comment or two. You know, with regard to the cell phones, I do think we do. You know, I was privileged to for briefly to was in the telecommunications committee. Mm. So we do manufacture. We do manufacture pretty good smartphones. The problem is Cell C, Vodacom and MTN don't want to buy them.
Exactly.
And that is, you know, the real problem is the South African market is too small to invest with these companies so that they can give them out as contracts. But I think the department at that side is working on that. So it is available and I think we're doing quite pretty well with regard to that. But then, it was mentioned by the Honourable Lotfi, data costs. But what I want to ask you, can you give us an indicator where South Africa fits with regard to data costs in terms of SADC, in terms of Africa, in terms of the rest of the world? And then also, secondly, you know, there's a new trend in the world that data is being rolled out by governments, the so-called WOAN. Mm. It's free. What is the indicators telling us where South Africa is standing with regard to Africa and to the world in terms of free data to its citizens? Because that will explain the problem with regard to why we have so many cell phones in the market, but you know it's really not utilized. And then finally, have you done any research? What are South Africans using this for? Because that will tell you the story.
Yeah.
You know why? You know we grow in terms of internet usage, but what are we using it for? Is it for Facebook? Is it for social media? What are we using it for? And if you haven't done that research, you know, I think you know that is vital information we need to know. What is that? Why is South Africa? What are they using this for? Because you know we can't outclass the rest of the world in terms of instruments, but we don't know what they're using it for. Okay, over to you, Doctor, or your team.
Thank you very much. I'm actually quite excited by this interaction because, to begin with, I wish I could answer all the questions because I think I would have had a different position myself. But what it does show is that this indicators report is capable of generating huge discussion and introspection, and it makes you more inquisitive about what is needed to get this economy right, and especially how to get innovation going. And that is the whole object of the exercise. So I'm absolutely delighted from that point of view. And clearly what it requires is far more interaction between NACI, the Department of Science and Technology, and people like yourselves to start putting out more and more feelers to the rest of the country into how to, you know, to raise these issues as issues to be debated, and to try, the more minds that are applied to this, the hopefully the more solutions we can find to the whole problem. So thank you very much. I think it has served its purpose and will continue doing so. And you've also given us some ideas of the kind of indicators we need to explore into widening the indicator base, such as the cost of data, which I think requires a lot more research. Superficially, I have seen some comparisons that show that South Africa has among the highest data costs in the world, and that countries like Kenya have far lower data costs, and that is why they are managing to use these instruments far more effectively in terms of enabling people to access finance and use it for all sorts of transactions that South Africans are not using. Yet my own gut feel is that South Africans are using this mainly for social media, which, relatively speaking, I would say is unproductive from a large economic base point of view, and it's also extremely costly. When I think about it, if it is used so extensively for social media and it is so costly, then it means that South Africans have less money available to spend on all sorts of other things that could uplift the economy and create more jobs. Now, I was asked by Honorable Kakana also, what do I see as, you know, the solutions? And how long have we got today? But really, this comes to some of the key structural weaknesses of the economy, and it also answers Honorable Lottering's question of why is the business sector not more involved. And it comes to, it's an issue of political debate, which has, I think, unfortunately been polarized into political agendas, but should really be broken down into real economic debate, and that is the concentration of power economically in South Africa in the hands of big organizations. And the chairman referred to the way in which MTN and Vodacom have been blocking some of the progress towards building cell phones in the country. And I think it goes far more broadly to the fact that the economy is controlled by a handful of interest groups. And I find it, and here I'm encroaching on political grounds, which maybe it shouldn't be, but I have been very frustrated at the whole concept of white monopoly capital as opposed to the role of monopoly capital, period. And I think until such time as South Africa's concentration of power is diffused into far more persons, small business, enterprising business, I think we will struggle to really maximize our opportunities. I had to do a presentation in Ghana 2 weeks ago, and I was taken for a drive around through the streets of Accra, and I was just so impressed at seeing how small business is just proliferating in that society. Each person making his own living by having a little shop, very orderly, clean, and you know, finding new ways of actually doing things. And I think that is the way to actually spread innovation in this country. I was delighted to hear that there are people who are actually manufacturing cell phones in the country, but clearly they are being stifled by big interest groups, and that has been a story throughout. I personally have been a victim of it in many ways in the financial sector, and continue to be so as an independent in my own right, because we've developed a society where there is no role for small small players have been just snuffled out of the whole system, and so you know, one can carry on and on talking about that, and it's one of the inhibitors, I believe, to the development of innovation in the private sector. The counterparty to that is, of course, that also breeds, there's been this admiration in South Africa for the so-called golden triangle of government and parastatals, big business and organized labor. And the masses have just been left out of this whole picture, unfortunately. And until that golden triangle is broken down and into a more diffused lot, I don't think we will achieve our full potential. May I also say in this regard, and in a number of the questions I was asked, I think, Honorable Tuck, your own question to some extent alludes to this, is what can we do in terms of like this discussion, spreading the ideas so that they start being debated more comprehensively in society and solutions are found. And it's something that we keep struggling as NACI, is the Chinese walls that seem to exist between different government departments and insufficient interaction between the two to cooperate and cross the lines so that we reach proper conclusions. Unfortunately, there is a political power play in each government department wanting to do its own thing rather than actually interacting. And with S&T specifically, so many of the issues that we deal with encroach upon other government departments, be it higher or lower education, be it trade and industry, be it public enterprises, etc., etc. And I wish somehow those divisions could be overcome to some extent. In regard to the role of maths and science, and yes, I think there is a sense in which one can argue that you know, you don't necessarily have to be a whiz kid in maths and science to actually innovate. The fact is that maths and science, it's not just a way of teaching people how to actually innovate specific technical objects, but it's a method through which logic is taught. I did my first degree in mathematics, even though I've never become a mathematician, and I struggled through it. It was damn hard work. I don't think you know, yes, you're right, there are some whiz kids who do it very easily. But what it did teach me was the concept of logical thought in going through, this is what I have to prove, this is the proof, and how do I get it out? What is the problem? How do I go about it? And that is the fundamental usefulness. And I think, yes, it's very easy to summarize and say, well, you don't need maths and science and you can innovate. The fact is that if you look at the output of world economies, who have been the most successful in the last 20, 30 years, it's without doubt the East Asian economies. And if you look at the progress that they have made in developing their science and a maths attribute, they have completely shot the lights out compared with the likes of the United States and Britain and so on. And that is why they've been succeeding so much economically. You cannot actually escape from that observation. And I would suggest that a lot of that problem lies with the fact that the quality of our teaching of maths and science is insufficient, and more than that, that is probably in your no fee paid schools, there isn't the money to employ the better teachers. And I've seen it. I'm on the board of an independent school. We raise our fees by much more than the CPI so that we can afford to hire teachers, and specifically maths and science teachers, at a higher salary to get the best out possible. And in fact, this is the way the world is going, and I know that there's a lot of things one can criticize about it, but it's almost like the football field where you pay the clubs pay the earth in order to get the best player to come and play for them. And that is a major problem that I think we face. And there has been a proposal time and again put forward that we need to try and, you know, the problem that I keep finding is how do we actually get this thing going? Can we rely on our own selves to develop our expertise in maths and science, or do we need an outside force to come in with new ideas and teaching concepts and allowing skilled maths and science teachers from elsewhere to come and help us? And I know we've been assisted significantly by the problems in Zimbabwe in that regard, because without having access to a lot of skills from Zimbabwe, we would have been even worse off to that extent. And so I get quite scared when I hear what's going on there, because will that see a countervailing outflow of some of those skills from the country? I fear. I don't know if there are any other issues. Can I pass on to Dr. Nayele to say that?
No, thanks, Chair, and honorable members, Dr. Jamin. Let me just make a few remarks. Maybe the first point we need to emphasize is that generally, as NEC, we don't think of innovation only in technological terms. Innovation takes different forms. There is social innovation. There is also public service innovation, which is supposed to help improve service delivery. There is little attention being paid in that regard, but it's beginning to happen. For instance, we could use Home Affairs as an example. So at least I was involved in their recent process of digitizing how Home Affairs function. We all know in the past how long it used to take us to get an ID, and how long does it take one now to get an ID. We often don't think of that as an innovation. The e-filing, as an example, that SARS is now utilizing, we often don't think of that as an innovation. So I think it's also important, because the non-technological innovation would generally involve people who are operating from the periphery in townships, in rural areas, who are less educated, but the intention is to find solutions to address the problems that they are facing, whether you're talking about grassroots innovation and so forth. So, you know, we would always encourage, even our own report, we do recognize that perhaps that's an area in the next version that we need to strengthen to bring more of that dimension, so that we provide a comprehensive sense of how South Africans are doing in respect of innovation in its broadest sense. The second point I want to make is that, of course, we have to rely on the Department of Science and Technology to facilitate engagement with the rest of government. This report will go to cabinet, and it will have to go through an economic cluster system. So, and we will have to present there, because part of the reason why it has to go to cabinet is to make sure that we are able to communicate with all relevant government departments. But of course, we need to draw policy implications from what these statistics are providing. And then cabinet will then decide on what to do with the report. So that's where the report is going, just to deal with a question of how do we involve the rest of the people. Other stakeholders we have interacted with them when we're launching the report, but we're also having a portal which we launched. It's publicly accessible now, and we continue to encourage people to access the portal so that they can have interactions through this report. The next version of this STI indicators report, I've just confirmed with the team that's working on it, would potentially deal with some of the indicators that have been raised here around data, cost, and so forth, which are not yet included. And there are other areas, but would also do some in-depth analysis. There is work that is being done to specifically focusing on maths and physics to understand why the problem continues, notwithstanding various interventions that government has invested. That work is currently underway. We are working with different experts in the system. The intention is to then generate recommendations to government in terms of how we can at least find solutions to this problem. We do understand, last week I met the executive director of Mapungubwe, Mr. Joel Netshitenzi, who will have just completed work on the language of teaching mathematics, and they will be launching a book next month at the Science Forum. So there are different people who are doing work around this area. Our intention is to harness and synthesize that work, and where there are gaps, we focus on it. So we're hoping that this report, once it's finalized next year, we should be able to propose to government in terms of what can be done to really tackle this. There are also other areas where we're also trying to understand much better what are the indicators stating, because it's one thing to say these are the statistics, they're saying this, but we need to unpack and understand so that we can be able to answer some questions sufficiently. But we also do recognize, honorable members, that I think Martin, they've just, the DOE, DBE, recently completed the ICTE education operation back in Pakistan. So we do encourage people, because that initiative, I think it articulates a range of what should be done to utilize ICT to intervene decisively in the education space. Of course, it's incumbent upon all of us to make sure that each one of us, as key stakeholders, we identify a role in which we could be participating in that ICT education operation Pakisa. And I think our role as NECI will be to reflect on that report and see, and the recommendations that are being proposed, and see to what extent we can make recommendations on how they can be better implemented. Let me just check the final point. Honorable Lodrick has gone out. Last year we did have a specific seminar, by the way, to where we invited business to answer the question that was posed earlier on why they're not investing as much as they should on R&D. Dr. Jamin will recall what the business people said. But again, it's usual reasons, policy uncertainty, which they were mentioning, and they, you know. But again, you still remain not so sure exactly what is it that you know, to provide the type of response that may be required. We do have the records of that engagement because it was a public engagement. But we think that it's quite a critical question that must continuously be asked, and the various platforms that happen will take that into consideration. Honorable Kekana, your direct question about whether we are aware about the lack of quantum engineering, I wasn't aware, but we do recognize historically that not all universities were meant to have engineering faculties. That's a historical fact, especially black universities. They were not meant, except the former University of Durban-Westville, that had an engineering faculty. The rest, by design, the law did not allow them to have. But I suspect it's an issue that, again, maybe the Department of Higher Education can be in a better position, or the Council on Higher Education can better be able to tackle. The issue around BRICS and the rest of the continent, I think it's also important. I was having a conversation with some of the colleagues who attended the post-Communist Party Congress in China. Last week, they invited a selected group of academics who were reflecting on the resolutions of that Congress. China is quite clear about the role that it wants to play in leading what it's called the emerging societies. And South Africa was represented by some of the academics, because the discourse that they are talking about is we need to reimagine the world in terms of these emerging societies playing a bigger role. They have identified specific activities that they would like to lead. The question, of course, to us as South Africa, I guess, as members of the BRICS, would be what is our role that we would like to play much more decisively? I guess it's the same question that we need to be asking about the role that we would like to be playing in the rest of the continent moving forward, given the fact that the Chinese and other emerging societies, they're also having a bigger role in the continent. I can make an example. Two or three years ago, we were invited by Ethiopia to come and train their SDI policy analysts. To my surprise, Chairperson, there were two of us. There was one professor from TUT and myself. We got there, we found that actually the entire two-week workshop was being run by the experts from the Republic of Korea. We were invited just to make, as it's very polite way, to make the program to look good, because South Africa is seen as leading in terms of innovation. But our role was really not significant. The Minister of Science and Technology there was being advised by a senior advisor, a retired senior advisor of KISTEP, who was deployed by the government of South Korea, on a full-time basis advising the Minister of Science and Technology. They were deploying academics who were going to teach at their universities. They had a program of taking senior government officials to be trained in South Korea. And they were, even in their own pronunciation, in the proclamation, they said they were benchmarking themselves against South Korea, not South Africa, even though they did recognize that we were leading. But they didn't see us. They were saying we want to be there, and therefore we want to learn what and how the South Koreans did it. So which then says to me some of the preliminary remarks made, that as a country we need to seriously think about how should we make sure that we don't wake up tomorrow and find ourselves lagging behind countries that we have never thought they would lead us. So the final point that I want to make while on this is that in as much as we do and we should encourage the individuals manufacturing things, but until such time that as a country we have few strategic priorities that we would collectively agree and say these are the things that we want to be investing in the next 5, 10, 15 years, we would always be having this challenge of individuals producing something but business not being interested, government not being investing. With a DG of DST, we recently, I think 2-3 years back, we visited few countries when we were trying to learn. It was surprising. The South Koreans, they told us that they are now reaping the fruit with Samsung of decisions that they made in the mid-80s. Because what they did, they undertook what is called a foresight exercise. Basically, they said, let's look ahead, few years, few decades ahead, and identify few technologies or the areas that we wanted to develop and be known for. And this was one of, the ICT was one of those. And they worked systematically since then, and they are now reaping the fruits of such investment. The second era was around automotive. It's the same thing with Malaysia. That's what they said with the Proton car. They said government took a decision that we would want to develop this capability, and then said no import would be allowed until the necessary sufficient market was generated internally. And then once they were settled, they then allowed, they were in a position of strength to then engage other international countries. So that's a process which we have proposed. Fortunately, the Minister of Science and Technology has agreed that NEC needs to undertake that exercise, which would happen soon, to conduct a foresight exercise, Chair, which we hope will then assist government next year to develop a new 10-year innovation plan. Hopefully, we should be able, through that process, to identify few key strategic priorities that we need to be pursuing in the next 10 to 20 years or so.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that, Dr. Swissman.
Mr. Chairman, there's a couple of questions that I know I recalled I didn't answer. Firstly, what is being done in terms of, we're saying that there may not have been a big change in SDI over the last 20 years. The Minister of Science and Technology deliberately appointed a task team to study the science, technology and innovation institutional landscape. Here I'm talking outside of NACI because I was part of the SDIIL study, where we looked at what have we done in terms of changing the institutions in science technology. One of the big issues that we raised was the fact that the population had more than doubled over this period, and the country had progressed, and yet we have exactly the same institutions still in place that existed in the mid-1990s. And clearly there has to be a lot of thought going into whether or not we should be establishing new institutions that can, you know, beyond just the HSRC, the CSIR, the ASAP and a few science councils to do the work that we do, to focus a lot more on. So, I mean, have we done enough in terms of developing an institutional capability to research ICT, for example? I believe not. Another issue that was raised was universities. And I've been grappling with this. Do we need to just focus on those who and develop innovation through expertise in science, in maths and science? And the answer is clearly no. One of the issues that has been highlighted on numerous occasions, and I need to once again highlight because it's very relevant in terms of some of the discussions that have been taking place around tertiary fees at the moment, is the fact that the proportion of students who go into technical training in South Africa is relatively low compared with university training. So there that is often mentioned is that in Germany, for example, the number of students coming out of, I don't know if it's coming out of or enrolling at technical institutions is 4 times the number that go to university. In South Africa, it's almost 1-to-1 at the moment. So, and that requires a bit of a change in the mindset of the population. There is this obsession in South Africa with the fact that, you know, to go and get a technical diploma is inferior to getting a university degree. That kind of concept needs to actually be shifted. And it needs, and I think one of the ways of shifting it could be if the remuneration from technical skills is suddenly started to be recognized as being far, far superior to just academic skills. And within academic skills, we've often identified, and you saw that, well, the ratio of science, engineering, technology compared with everything else is kind of constant. It hasn't improved. Instead, what we're seeing, and every second kid that comes from an independent school, oh, where are you going to university? What are you going to study? Oh, I'm going to do Bachelor of Business Science at UCT. Bachelor of Business Science at UCT. And, you know, it's all very well. That's develops managerial expertise, but it doesn't develop the wherewithal to start producing things and innovating things. And you will have noticed in some of the data that I showed how the financial services sector has expanded massively. And I know we regard it as a huge strength in the economy, but it's also part of the debilitating factor in the stifling development of expertise in some of the other areas of the economy. And often you find even people who get PhDs in maths are now going into financial engineering rather than into actually producing goods and services. How we also break the dominance of the big five universities is also a challenge, and I think it probably I think theoretically the way to do it would be to develop the educational outcomes at primary and secondary level of some of the more outlying regions of the country so that the students that go to those universities actually start uplifting those universities and start taking pride in actually getting a degree from those universities to plough back those skills into their own rural communities if necessary.
Okay, thank you very much. Martin, do you want to add something?
If you would indulge me, Chair, just for one quick point. I thought the question from the Honourable Tuck was particularly important. The information that has been given today, where is it shared, with whom, on what situations, and how? And just a thought to leave with the Honourable Members is whether this committee would consider calling a joint meeting of Department of Social Development, which is responsible for ECD, Department of Basic Education responsible for primary and secondary, Department of Higher Education responsible for tertiary, and Department of Science and Technology, which promotes postgraduates in the STEM disciplines. Specifically look at what we're doing about that pipeline from the origin right through to PhD with the postdoc. Because the question, I understood it as being, what is the coherence that is taking place in order to address this very serious problem? And it may also go to the question of expanding research-intensive institutions beyond the few that currently exist, and making sure all 26 are able to produce serious scientists. Thank you, Chair.
And thank you very much for that. You know, we've made a note with regard to that. I'm looking towards the members. Is there anything in particular urgent that you finally want to clear, or can we, Honourable Tuck?
Yeah, I think he's covered me now, but I need to clear something on the question that Honourable Sandy did ask about the gifted people in South Africa or wherever gifted, because I understood that what she said is she was talking about people who was gifted, like the Down syndrome person who can be who is a mechanic or something like that. I'm just worried. There's no indication what's happening to those people. That's what I want to know.
Thank you very much. I think Dr. Jasmin touched on that to say that we must grow beyond this. If you've got a degree, then you will be better off That's nonsense. In this country, it is definitely nonsense. And I think we should educate people more not to be afraid to do just, you know, a technical diploma or just to use the skills or your talents, and then you can still make a very good living. You know, there's so many graduates that after 3 years they graduate university, but then they go on a list and be unemployed.
Mm.
So it is a sad story sometimes from thinking that you will arrive after going to university. But thank you very much, members, for that. There's just two housekeeping things. We've got an invitation from NAACI. They are running a conference in the first week of December on Tuesday the 5th and the 6th. We will process that. It's a very interesting program, and I think, you know, if you can go there, it will be very, very enlightening. So thank you very much for that invitation. And then also with regard to the possibility of a study tour, we have been asked by the committee section to resubmit. We will resubmit today, and the new dates will be the third week in, or just the second half of January next year. So let's hold our thumbs that this time we can be successful convincing Parliament to send us. So with that, thank you very much for the inputs. It's always nice and good to interact with NAACI, and all the best for the good work you are doing. Meeting is adjourned.
Sure. Reminder, where are we going for study
tour? Papa, can I see you?
It is Japan and South Korea.
Oh, yes, okay.
Did they lower down that?
Interesting study. Something that I